Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We've told you in the past, we like to highlight student journalism on The Green, whether it's high schoolers in our Generation Voice youth media program at Mount Pleasant and McCain High Schools, or college students at the University of Delaware and Delaware State University. This spring, we have a UD intern, DJ McCauley, focusing on science and health reporting. And she's produced a terrific piece on the Control of Balance and Locomotion Lab at the University of Delaware's Star Campus. It examines that lab's use of a virtual reality cave to study balance issues in people ranging from healthy older adults to people suffering from Parkinson's disease and concussions. You can find DJ's piece right now at DelawarePublic.org. And she set up an interview with Jacqueline Cassis, a postdoctoral researcher in UD's Department of Kinesiology and Applied Physiology, working at the lab. I recently visited Cassis there to chat about the lab's work and the VR cave.
Give us a sense of what kind of work you're doing here in this lab.
Sure. So our lab studies how people use sensory information to balance. So sensory systems like your vision, so seeing with your eyes. We also have an inner ear balance system called your vestibular system. And then the third sensory system we use for balance is our proprioception or our somatosensory system. So that's kind of like sensors in your muscles and joints that tell your body where it's positioned in space. And so we try to understand how both healthy individuals and neurological populations use different sensory systems to balance. So for example, we'll have people walking on our treadmill, and while they're walking, we'll try and disturb their vision. So we'll do things like rotate the scene as they walk. And this will give us an idea of how they're using that visual information to balance. And like I said, both in healthy individuals and then some of the neurological populations we work with include healthy older adults, people following head injury or concussion, people with Parkinson's disease, children with cerebral palsy. Those are the majority of the work that we're doing right now fall under those headings.
So we're in the virtual reality VR cave. Can you give us kind of a thumbnail sketch of, first of all, what the VR cave is and how it kind of works overall?
Yeah, so you may be familiar with some of the head-mounted displays that people use. Those are becoming increasingly common. I think from a clinical perspective, those will probably be the direction that some of the research takes off. But in our exploring the sensory information, it's actually easier to use a cave because a person can walk in and we can put them in any location, but they don't have something actually on their head. So particularly for some of the patient populations, it's a little uncomfortable or, you know, the system's heavy and while they're trying to move.
And it's not natural either.
Correct, yeah, and it's not natural. It's also challenging sometimes because they can't see, like, their legs, and people like to be able to see your legs while you walk. So the system we have now, it's a 12-foot virtual reality cave, and we have a split belt treadmill. And so what that means is that each belt can move independently. And so there's a projector, and we create all our own scenes in-house. So if we want to put somebody, you know, in a grocery store, we would create a scene for a grocery store, and it would be projected. And then one of the kind of key components is the motion capture system. So there are cameras around the cave, and they look like normal video cameras, but they work slightly differently. So they send out light, and they wait for it to reflect back. So we put reflective markers kind of typically around 60 locations across a person's body, and so we can see how their body moves. And that will allow us not only to understand their movement, but also it will allow them to interact in our virtual reality scene. So if their head moves to the right, the scene will move accordingly.
So what are some of the things that using the VR cave does to help you better understand balance? How is it kind of, what is it providing you that maybe you couldn't get otherwise?
One of the things is our ability to disturb a person's balance. So like I had mentioned earlier, we will have the scene rotate as a person walks. And it kind of gives the illusion that you're falling to one side or the other, and then we can understand how they react or respond to that to understand falls, fall risk, along those lines. The other thing we can do is we could have individuals interact with the scene. So one thing that a lot of people tend to have problems with, particularly even healthy older adults, is dual tasking. So doing two things at the same time. And so an example that I like to give, although we're not really doing it right now, but think of walking through the grocery store and you have the list in your mind and you're trying to remember what items you need to buy and look at the items, kind of visually scan the aisle while you're walking. And so that tends to be challenging for individuals, even healthy individuals. And so we can do things like that where they have some type of cognitive task that they're thinking of at the same time that they're walking.
Your lab works with Parkinson's patients and those with balance issues due to inner ear dysfunction. How is your research kind of connecting with these groups and how might it affect them going forward?
So one of the things that we're trying to explore now are the different mechanisms that people use to balance while walking. So typically, a lot of the existing research focuses on navigation. So which direction a person is walking, which obviously vision is crucial for that. But there's also a balance component to vision. And that really hasn't been explored, particularly in patient populations. So there are three main balance components that we've kind of identified. The first being where a person puts their foot. So as they're walking, they might take a wider or a more narrow step, and that helps you balance while walking. Another thing is kind of rolling their foot, their stance foot. So while you walk, you have one foot in stance and one foot in swing, and you can kind of roll your foot in and out to help you balance as you walk. And then the third one is when you actually go to push off onto your next foot, kind of how strongly you push off. And so we are looking at how different patient populations, so for example, individuals with Parkinson's disease, modulate those balance mechanisms. And the thought is that perhaps certain populations use more of one balance mechanism than another. And if we can understand that, then we can try and develop interventions where we can either have them use more or less of a particular balance mechanism or teach them to use a particular balance mechanism if it's possible.
And in this environment, the VR environment, is it easier both to see what they're doing and also then test out those possible interventions?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So the virtual reality is a huge component of that, being able to not only test it, but also see if we can improve it. And the motion capture is the other big component to that. So without that, we wouldn't really be able to understand how the person is responding.
You also look at concussions. Tell us a little bit about how they affect balance and how you can use the VR cave to better understand what people are dealing with concussions and how to address them.
That's my project, so it's a little bit easier to speak to that. So there are a number of things that we look at. So one is acute concussion. So immediately following concussion, there are balance disturbances. One of the kind of larger issues we see is that they're more disturbed by all sensory stimuli. So if a scene is moving, they'll respond much more dramatically than someone who is not concussed. And so teaching them to kind of play around with that information and maybe downweight it a little bit so they're not relying so much on it is important in terms of a rehabilitation perspective. But the other thing that we're trying to understand is more of the persistent effects. So over time, in individuals who are recovering from concussion and then also individuals who sustain repetitive head impacts. So there are sports like football. Sure, concussions occur, but there are a lot of head impacts that don't result in acute concussion. And so how those present. And so one of the things we're finding, particularly in soccer players, which is the current project we're looking at, so a lot of people think repetitive head impacts are bad, which they may or may not be. That's still not totally understood. But there's a difference in balance between people following just a series of repetitive head impacts and concussion. So the repetitive head impacts tend to cause people to downweight their vestibular information, which might not be a bad thing. So your vestibular system is the balance system in your inner ear, and it works kind of like a pair of accelerometers. There are accelerometers in your cell phone, so if you turn the orientation of your cell phone, it matches, right? Well, the vestibular system does the same thing. It tells your eyes and your body how to adjust with the movement of your head. And so the vestibular system is designed to operate during standing and walking and fairly slow movements. And so if you think about heading a soccer ball, you have a really high acceleration in the head, right? And so what these athletes tend to be doing is they downweight that vestibular information and they rely more on their vision and their proprioception, which may actually be somewhat protective. I hate to say that because it's too early to know, but the idea being that their visual information is probably more reliable because they're not having a huge, you know, the acceleration is quite high compared to following concussion where they're just more disturbed all around. So those two things are presenting somewhat differently.
How useful is studying the sports aspect of it, both just in, you know, kind of regular activity like heading a ball, and concussed sports athletes, helpful in figuring out how best to treat those non-athletes who have concussions?
Yeah, I think that's very important for a couple reasons. First, the sports athletes are typically very motivated to get back to sport. So when you provide some type of intervention, they're going to be, you know, extremely motivated to test that intervention to see if it works. The other thing is that there are a lot more sport-related concussions, particularly among youth athletes. So we can take some of the techniques that we can study in a larger cohort and then apply it to some of the, I mean, you know, automobile accidents and falls in older adults are very common and do result in concussion. But it's a bit easier to recruit the younger athletes and to test different rehabilitation interventions in those individuals.
Is it also interesting to be looking at younger folks and maybe looking at it in relation to brain development and how that may work?
Yeah, so one of the projects that we're working on is looking at the age of first exposure to sport, and we really haven't found anything, which is contrary to what we had expected. So we thought that individuals who started participating in sports at a younger age would potentially have more balance problems, but that doesn't appear to be the case, which is certainly a good thing. And I think it also has a pretty big social, like a societal implication, because a lot of sports now are trying to limit participation for youth athletes. But in our collegiate athletes, we don't appear to be seeing any differences between people who start, for example, before age 12 compared to after age 12. And, you know, that's not to say that later life impairments don't develop. It's certainly possible. But from the data that we have a bit available right now, it doesn't seem like that makes a difference.
So that might have some implications for parents who are worried about starting their kids in sports young, or even sports like soccer, where I know coaching you soccer, they try to discourage heading the ball when you're younger because they think that might be a good idea.
Yeah, right. So it's definitely too early to say definitively one way or another, but I can say that in all the data we have available to us, it doesn't seem to make a difference whether, you know, you start playing soccer and heading the ball at age 10 versus 14.
What other projects do you foresee this lab working on in the future?
So one of the projects that I'm hoping to get started shortly is looking at some of the later life effects following concussion and repetitive head impact in sport. So, for example, recruiting 50 to 70-year-old or even older individuals who have a history of concussion or, you know, played football or soccer during their youth or adolescence, and looking at some of those later life effects that I had alluded to earlier. Another project, again, is kind of looking at the balance mechanisms in older adults, people with Parkinson's, and children with cerebral palsy. I know the children with cerebral palsy is a project that we're getting started on pretty soon. And then probably one project kind of down the line is looking at individuals following stroke. There's so much stroke research at the University of Delaware, so there would be a lot of potential for collaboration there too.
And finally, I mean, you know, as this technology develops, is there kind of a, you know, for you kind of a dream scenario where, like, that hey, we could really study X or Y once we kind of have this technology, even like going, having the ability to use the headsets maybe a little bit more. Do you see some like real implications maybe further down the road for what you're doing here?
Yeah, I think one of the big things I had alluded to earlier was the dual tasking. And I think there's a lot of potential for rehabilitation using dual task interventions. So if we know that, you know, an older adult, for example, is going to struggle, the example I gave earlier was grocery shopping, right? Then we can put them in a safe environment where they're in a harness and they can explore the boundaries of their balance and cognition and have them practice there so that now when they go out into the community, they feel more comfortable and more confident doing some of those dual task activities.
Thanks to UD postdoctoral researcher Jacqueline Cassis for inviting us to the Control of Balance and Locomotion Lab at the University of Delaware's Star Campus and its VR Cave. And remember, you can check out our intern contributor DJ McCauley's story on the VR Cave right now at DelawarePublic.org. And The Green continues in a moment with another edition of Arts Playlist, featuring the Rehoboth Art League and its efforts to highlight the importance of art preservation. You're listening to Delaware Public Media.